better way to do this. Let me show you a better way.
And we are live. Welcome, folks, to episode 3533 of the Survival Podcast. And while we're going to talk mostly about permaculture and integrated systems, there's a Bitcoin angle on this one, too. And when you hear my guest name, if you didn't read the intro, you'll understand why. Rev Hoddle is going to be on with us in just a moment. But we're going to mainly be talking about integrated permaculture systems today and kind of revolving around the concept of colony rabbits. Colony rabbits is where you don't have all the rabbits like in their own little box. And then, you know, you bring the girl to the boy and then they do the thing and then you bring them back and they have babies and you grow them out. Colony rabbits is basically like you give the rabbits a rabbit yard, like a rabbit pasture, a place that they're confined to. And they all live together and somehow it works, even though I think we've been folks have tried to convince us that it won't. And I have found people doing this here and there over the years, and I have tried really hard to get somebody on, and I get the same answer every time, and I have no idea why. But it's always, but I'm not an expert. I'm not a subject matter expert. I don't know enough yet. And you're like, well, how long have you been doing this? Like 10 years. I think you know more than most people, and that's all you need to know. So when I saw Rev doing this in a really cool way on Noster, I DM'd him and like, will you come on and talk about this? And I was already expecting the same answer because it has to be a good 10 times that I've been turned down to get somebody on the show talking about colony rabbits. And he was like, no, I'll do that. I've been listening to your show a long time and all that. Great. So we got that set up and we'll have Rev on in just a moment. Before we do, let's hear from our sponsors of the day. Sponsor day number one today is Anton's Land of Biltong because life is too short for average. You know what I had for breakfast today? Duor's dry sausage from Anton's Land of Biltong. Anton pays me in Biltong sausages, and I couldn't be happier about it. If you give Anton's product a try, you'll see why. It's just fantastic. Check out the Wagyu Biltong. It is just freaking amazing. Anton is right from South Africa, came here as an immigrant. He knows how to make it the right way. I go back with Biltong so long, but I learned how to make it from Peter Hathaway Capstick's book, Death in the Long Grass. And I've been a fan of it ever since. And having a couple bags of it, along with some Duar's dry sausage, sent to my house every other week, it's just awesome. You should check it out. Remember, you get a discount if you're an MSB member. And also remember, Anton is dealing with the Department of Making You Sad. He has a strong desire to get out of the small town he's in and move to his new location. He's trying to liquidate as much inventory as possible. So right now you can feed your Biltong tooth and fight the state at the same time and get a discount. So that's a great deal. Next up, the Freedom Trinity webinar. If you're tired of the state but you don't want to move, well, how about existing outside the system? That's what John Bush is teaching right now at Live Free Academy. The Freedom Trinity webinar will teach you how to set up things like private membership associations and how to be out in the open, yet out of the system. Really cool stuff. You can sign up and take the seminar. Check it out. There's links for both of our sponsors and all other kinds of good stuff down in the video links below. If you're listening to the audio, everything's on the audio side as far as links, resources, etc. And so if you're in the video right now live, there's a link right up at the top of the video notes that will take you over to that audio edition. If you do it while we're live, we're not done yet, so it won't be there yet. About 30 minutes after we wrap up with the live portion of this, we'll be ready to do that. With that, let's bring our long-awaited special guest, Carl Rev Hoddle, on with us. Rev, man, welcome to the show.
Hey, Jack. Really happy to be here. Like you said, I've been listening to the show a long time, so it's really exciting for me to get to talk with you about the rabbits today and whatever else we might get into.
Yeah, I was really excited when you said yes, and right after we set this up and Dorothy got you scheduled, I saw that you were on another Bitcoin podcast, and I don't remember what the show was called, but it was on Fountain. I'm like, well, I'm going to definitely listen to this. And I was impressed with kind of your mad scientist ways and how you're doing all this cool permaculture stuff and you're actually integrating Bitcoin with it as well. So I think it'll be something for everybody in this episode.
Oh, yeah. Ever since I found Bitcoin, I always talk about Bitcoin as kind of like the missing piece to my homesteading journey, my my path as a prepper, and so I've managed to find quite a bit of ways to integrate Bitcoin into the homesteading lifestyle that I live here, and I'm happy to get further into that too.
Yeah, we'll do that. I actually have come to an epiphany that I think a lot of like the urban suburban agricultural concerns, like the 1 acre greenhouses and all. If you can combine like biochar and Bitcoin with those, you can turn them from barely break even to very profitable really quick. And I think we can scale that back into homestead situations and make our efforts pay off more for us.
Oh, no doubt. The Bitcoin, so many aspects of the Bitcoin have like supercharged the systems here at the homestead. And a lot of that has to do with Bitcoin mining and basically giving your Bitcoin miner a job in the form of helping you subsidize the production or work that it's producing in the form of that heat. But yeah, there's a lot that I think is unexplored when it comes to integrating Bitcoin mining into homesteading. And not to mention just the aspect of the participation in the Bitcoin community has been giving me more market access for the products that I'm producing as well. So
very cool. So let's start off with like some of your integrated systems. Let's kind of push like the permaculture angle first, and then we'll switch over to how that integrates with Bitcoin. So you can just talk from a permaculture standpoint about some of the way you're integrating systems on your property.
Sure. So I'll start off. I've got a 20-acre homestead here. I've been living here about 10 years. I got my PDC for Midwest Permaculture in 2016, but I'd been studying permaculture for several years before that. So it's safe to say that I've been practicing permaculture for over 10 years now as well. And so what we do here at the homestead is our main cash flow is short-term rentals in the form of this yurt and this tiny house that I built. But we also raise sheep, which are integrated in with our it's like a food forest style silvopasture system. So we've got all sorts of different fruit trees growing together with hazelnuts planted in between those trees. And then under the story of those is horseradish, rhubarb, asparagus, strawberries, raspberries, all that kind of stuff. And so we're grazing the sheep amongst those trees. And we've got those two systems integrated together. The next system is the rabbit colony. We're raising rabbits in a colony system. But what we've done to integrate into that system is we're actually growing our cannabis in that system as well. So we basically just exclude the cannabis from the rabbits, and then we use the cannabis to produce seed. So the rabbits their job is to help subsidize the production of this cannabis seed that we produce. In addition to that, we've got this maple syrup production area, but we've also integrated our horses and our rams into that system as well. So you might start to get the idea that each system that we've got, we're giving the animal a job in addition to whatever yield it's producing. We're getting not only cannabis seed from our rabbit colony, but also the rabbit meat and the fertility from the rabbits as well. And finally, we've got our egg-laying chickens, and now we've actually gotten some ducks as well, some Muscovies, which we use to compost the horse manure that's coming from our horses. So
that's cool. I heard you say the rams. So basically, are you like separating? You're using your rams unless you're breeding them, and then so like the rams are kind of off with the horses. Is that the way I got that?
Yeah. So you can imagine, basically, if you think of our sugar maple bush as a circle, out on the outer edge of that circle, we've got a track, a narrow track in which the horses run on. So we keep our horses off the pasture to maximize the pasture for raising our lamb meat. And then inside the center of that track is about 2 acres in which we unleash the rams over the summertime. And so the rams do the job of cleaning up the forest part and keeping the understory growth down. So then when I come in the wintertime to collect the maple sap, there's not anything in my way. And this was kind of a result of this idea in permaculture of this successional designing over time, right? So we started off with this marginal area that was a closed canopy forest. I realized that eventually there was a lot of sugar maple trees in there and I could tap them and start making a product out of there. So then I hired a forestry consultant to advise me on which trees to cut down and sell to promote the growth of the sugar maple trees. At that same time, we ended up getting horses. So while the loggers were there, I asked the loggers to take the trees out this way, take them out that way, creating this path around the outside edge of that stand of sugar maples. Once we integrated the horses in, at the same time, we were managing our sheep rotationally. In two different groups, right? We've got three rams, basically, that we're moving every 2 to 4 days, let's say, and then this group of 20 ewes and maybe the 40 lambs that go with it that we're moving every 2 to 4 days. And the problem is that it's just about as much work to move those three sheep as it is to move those 60. And so this was a problem that I needed to solve. And at the same time, I'd opened up so much light in the canopy on this sugar maple bush that all of this new growth was coming in where it wasn't before. And so I just realized one day that I've got this donut shape of fencing, and in the donut shape of fence is all this stuff that could be food for rams. And that would, so basically now I realized, oh, I just unleash my rams into the center of this fence. They keep the forest floor clean. I get to be able to collect the maple syrup, the maple sap, and I don't have to move them nearly as often. And they got a nice shady place to play all summer.
And that's kind of back to the old Seth Holzer line. If you don't want to do a certain job, you need an animal to do it for you. He kind of did it the other way around where somebody said, but what if I don't? He was explaining a system with pigs, and he's like, the person's like, well, what if I don't want pigs? And he said, then you have to do the pig's job. So you make sure the animal has a job, and every job an animal does is one less job you have to do.
Indeed, yes. And usually the job that they're doing is often feeding them. So yeah. That means that I have to spend less money on the input cost of their feed as well. And then I'm getting these yields not only in the form of whatever, if it be eggs from the chickens, meat from the rabbits, I'm also getting the yield of their fertility as well, in addition to the work that they do. So you can start to see maybe how when you this permaculture principle of integrate rather than segregate is like one that we've really taken to a lot here at the homestead, and it's really caused a lot of our it's allowed us to do a lot more with just my wife and I than I think normally would be possible.
Awesome. So let's start talking about the colony rabbits, right? Because this is something I wanted to talk about for a while. What made you decide, I don't want to do rabbits in a box? I want to do rabbits like that are allowed to be rabbits and commingle and hang out. And, you know, I kind of got a view as to how reasonable this is, I guess, maybe the way. I was down for John Bush's exit and build this March, and we're at this Airbnb, and I see a rabbit in the front yard near the evening, and it's not a cottontail. It's like somebody's domestic rabbit. And I think, well, somebody's pet got away. 4 hours, or not 4 hours, like maybe 40 minutes later, really close to dark, there was like a dozen domestic rabbit escapees that had colonized this property, not in the way that you are where you're containing, but clearly the rabbits we raise for meat are not so much different than the rabbits that live in the wild, and they can coexist and live together. And what kind of gave you the impetus to take that approach?
So it's kind of this idea of following the succession of systems, using that permaculture principle of self-regulate, accept and apply feedback. And so, and also the problem is the solution. This is another permaculture catchphrase, I guess you could say, that rings true to me a lot. And so we started off, the first thing I did is when I bought this property is I built one of these Seth Holzer style hugel culture mounts because I had a lot of sapling trees to clear up out of the pasture. And I thought, well, I could pull all these trees up out of the pasture, pile them up and make like this cool hugel culture. And you might be able to see that. I see you're pulling up the picture. You might be able to see that hugel culture just past the cannabis down the slope there. But the problem was is that I built this thing incorrectly. I had not really followed any of the good rules of thumb. I just basically made a pile of wood and pushed the dirt to the hill and covered it up. And it never really effectively worked as a hugel culture mound, at least for, it still wasn't working. So ultimately led, I had cleared out this area of pasture, though, which was a nice southern exposure. So once the laws got changed here in Michigan that I could start growing cannabis, I found that that was a perfect place to put my cannabis garden. So now I have this hugel culture mound that's not just doing nothing but growing weeds, and I'm growing the cannabis there. But now, once again, there's weeds growing up amongst my cannabis that I have to manage. And so at the same time, we had started raising the rabbits in cages, and we realized that the cages, while they're convenient, it is more of an active management process where you have to be, you know, collecting and doing something with the manure, filling the water up so frequently, feeding them. It felt like too much of a chore to raise the rabbits in the cages, and we just didn't like the idea of having them caged anyways. And so we started using this John Siskovich style chicken tractor. We basically put 2x4 welded wire on the bottom of it, and we were tractoring the rabbits around that way inside this chicken tractor. And that ended up being a little bit better, but still a lot of work. And eventually we just realized, well, we've got fence around this cannabis garden. We've got this hugel culture mound, which would probably be a perfect place for them to make their burrows. All I have to do is add some chicken wire around the fence of the cannabis garden and exclude the stalks of the cannabis from the rabbits, and we can just unleash them in there and see what happens. And so it was just kind of this successive string of feedback that we didn't like the way we were doing the rabbit. The cannabis was a little bit more work than we wanted to get somebody else to do that work for us, right? Give an animal the job of weeding the cannabis. So now, because we've unleashed the rabbits into the cannabis garden, the rabbits weed and fertilize the cannabis. And this might have come up before in other shows about rabbits, but rabbit manure is not hot. So you can, the plants in which the rabbits are producing that manure under, they can start to access that fertility immediately without any rest or compost time. So rabbits made this perfect symbiotic relationship with the cannabis as long as we could keep them away from the main stalk, where they're weeding and fertilizing the cannabis. And then actually, because we're growing outside this cannabis, the cannabis grows so large that we can afford to sacrifice some of it and feed it to the rabbits. That was another issue that I was having with this cannabis garden, was that we were actually producing so much cannabis that I couldn't hardly give it all away. And so I would find myself composting cannabis, which is kind of crazy. And so we figured if we're going to be throwing this into the compost pile, we might as well feed it to something. And once again, that's where the rabbits come in. Now we can feed our extra cannabis to the rabbits and turn it into meat instead of just compost.
Did you have any trouble when you started doing this, like any kind of rabbit conflict, rabbit warfare, any of the things that people say you shouldn't do this because these bad things will happen that you had to make adjustments for? Like, and I guess, like, how big is the area roughly? And how many rabbits are in there at any one time?
So the area is basically, it's a little smaller than one 330-foot roll of woven wire fence. And it's not a perfect circle or anything, so it's kind of a rough idea. I actually should know better about the exact square footage of it. We keep three breeding does and one buck, and it's way more square footage than what you need for that small number of breeding stock.
Hold on, I missed that. You keep one buck and how many does?
Three does.
Okay, it's one buck and three does. So that big group of rabbits there, a lot of those are future graduates.
Yes, we're going to eat all those.
Okay.
And so this kind of comes to your point of like, do they fight? Because they're territorial, and once they do get mature, the kits that grow up, they start to battle for their little space inside this colony. And when we do find the rabbits fighting, that's when we know we should start harvesting them. And this is another different aspect when you're raising the rabbits in a colony versus the cages, is that they do grow out a little bit slower, or maybe a lot slower. In my experience, we kind of just, we don't harvest them all as one group. We just kind of harvest one, like, oh, that's a good size one, and we grab it and we eat it. We just kind of go as we just eat as we go, instead of harvesting a bunch at once. Granted, sometimes we'll do like an event at the homestead and we'll get like six or seven rabbits at once and cook them all up or whatever. But so,
and I guess if you ever wanted to, like, okay, the conflict has begun, I don't feel like processing all of these bunnies right now, they could always be relocated somewhere for temporary until you, like, if you wanted to wait till a weekend or something, you could always do something like that.
And we have done that, where we catch a bunch and put them in the cage, in cages for a while before we harvest them or process them. But for the most part, we just grab them and do them right away. And this is what we love about rabbits versus, like, let's say a broiler chicken, is that the processing time of a rabbit is just so fast and easy. From the time I touch that rabbit to the time that it's in the fridge is typically less than 10 minutes. And a lot of that's just walking back and forth between my house and where the rabbit colony is, you know.
Yeah.
So some of the other issues that we ran into, when we first put the rabbits into the colony, there was a lot of grass and clover and there's all kinds of plants in there still. But eventually, after about 1 year, the rabbits had eaten up everything, to where the only thing that they won't eat in there is stinging nettle. And so I think this actually caused a little bit of a problem, where we were dealing with some eye infections. We weren't adding enough carbon to the system in the form of straw or wood chips or whatever they could use to, like, clean their burrows and their nests. And so we were getting some eye infections for a while. But as soon as we started adding more hay and straw and things like that to the system, the eye infections cleared up and they went away. We've never had any issues with, like, let's say fly strike or any common rabbit diseases. As far as we know, we haven't had any issues. We've been doing this system for several years, at least 3 years now.
Yeah, I did find that when you confine anything, they will eat everything eventually, except the things that they really don't want to eat, and then that can be a problem. I had quail, for instance, in an aviary, and they ate everything that grew in the aviary, and then there was a nightshade that they ate, and it made them psychotic, and I had to pull it all out to get rid of it. But they never touched it until it was the only thing left. So I do think the idea of bringing in carbon and making sure they have enough feed, and then as they take away the ice cream and they start to go, oh, what is this last green thing? no matter what critter it is, like, that's something you have to keep an eye on.
Yeah, and they will, if for whatever reason they're not getting enough food, they'll start to nibble on that stinging nettle, but they really don't like it. And I'm not sure why.
From listening to your stuff on other podcasts and, like, reading your Noster stuff, it seems like one of the things you're doing is, like, well, if I have to go weed this place anyway, then all the weeds go to the rabbits.
Yes, and that's the primary. In the summertime, that's primarily how we feed the rabbits. We do supplement with this custom grain mix that we made. We put a little molasses on there and some mineral. Just about 2 quarts of that a day for that. All those, I don't know if there's 50 or 60 rabbits in that whole system, but just a little bit of grain, just to make sure that they do have, they're getting a balanced diet. Because a lot of times, you know, they'll be getting a lot of comfrey or a lot of cut plant or a lot of whatever it is that I'm weeding, and there's not as much diversity from day to day, so that grain mix helps to smooth that out. But yes, we basically...
Go ahead.
We basically just heart, like, anytime I'm... here's a good example. So we grow in our nursery, in our apple tree nursery, we grow our strawberries in there, and this is another example of integrating a system. So we grow our strawberries in the understory of the apple trees. The strawberries act as a ground cover to compete with the grass so that the nursery stock grows better. When I go to harvest those strawberries, I'm weeding those strawberries at the same time. So now I got my bucket of strawberries and my pile of weeds, and I go take the strawberries inside and I throw the weeds to the rabbits. As I'm weeding my food forest every day, basically what I found, anywhere from 1 to 2 wheelbarrows full of weeds is enough to feed those rabbits without really needing to do anything more than supplement their feed with the grain. Now, in the wintertime, what we do is we harvest basically all the rabbits down to just the breeding stock. They don't tend to breed in the wintertime, so now we're just feeding the grain to the breeding stock, and we're not trying to actually raise meat. And that kind of limits the amount of meat production that we can get in the year with this system. We end up basically with about 50 rabbits that we finish out, and they finish out. The ones that, when we finish them, they're averaging about 3 pounds each as the carcass.
Yeah, man, so, that would be up for... You know, if you're using one rabbit to a meal, that's a rabbit a week for a year. If you're using two, it's a rabbit every other week for a year. That's kind of the incremental approach I talk to people about when I talk about raising, like, small livestock. Like, when they start, I want to grow all my own food. Well, let's figure out how to get one thing to feed you once a week. And then let's do that again and do that again, and we can get into a very high percentage of our own produced calories that way without... Because you know what happens, man. You've seen it. I'm going to get a place, man, and I'm going to get cattle and pigs and chickens. And, like, 6 months later, that person is on YouTube ripping their hair off of the top of their head.
Yeah, it's easy to get going with a lot of stuff too fast. And we've basically gotten to the point where all of our time is full and we're not really looking to add any new systems. We're just trying to now go from this pattern of the systems that we've got and focus on the details and really making these systems hum and be more efficient. And I guess that leads to one of the other downsides of this colony system is that we tend to, the most times we lose the rabbits are due to heavy weather events like rain, like heavy rains basically, that will cause their burrows to collapse or they'll flood and drown the kids. And so this is why we're not able to, like, necessarily finish as many rabbits as we'd hope, or as you would think. Like, if one of those breeding stock can produce 6 to 8 kits every month, you think you'd have more rabbits than you can handle. But we do lose a lot to nature in this system. But the thing that what makes that okay in this system is that we're really using the rabbits once again for the job of helping to grow this cannabis. And the cannabis, we actually sell the seed. So the sales of the cannabis seed actually subsidize the food costs for the rabbits to the point where we're basically getting the rabbit meat for free and we're still getting some revenue from the cannabis seed that we sell. Integrating these two systems together, you end up with this, like, supercharged thing where you're spending less time getting more yields and there's food that's as a byproduct of it.
So I've noticed that, you know, obviously the cannabis plants this time of year look pretty huge. They have, like, a mesh around the base so the rabbits can't devour them and get rabbit highs. But, I mean, it would be worse if they're damaging the crop. So that's why that's there. But I do notice there's, like, a lot of empty space. There's a lot of, looks like straw you're using as a carbon source for them. But there are some green plants growing with the rabbits that I guess they're not destroying, even if they eat a little bit of. What do you have growing in there that's not protected? Is it mint? It's, like, kind of right in the center there.
That's that stinging nettle. So there's stinging nettle kind of taking over everything. They just won't eat that. Now, there's some ideas that I have around how to maybe, and Marjorie Wildcraft and other people have done this kind of with the cages with the sweet potato shoots coming out, and the rabbits just kind of nibble at those. Just some ideas around that, like that, where I could start to get some more food growing for them in the system. And a good example of that, actually, right at the front of the photo, there's a little tiny tree. That's a mulberry tree. And so I planted mulberry trees all around the outside of the colony. So that way, as those mulberries mature, I'll get some shade. The rabbits will be a little bit cooler, and I'll be able to actually just prune the trees right there and throw in the food for them as the season progresses. I've also got my apple rootstocks are planted on the downslope. You can't see them in the background, but I'm doing the same thing as to keep those apple rootstocks from overgrowing. I hack away at them every fall and feed those to the rabbits. So you can grow the food for the rabbit colony just on the outside of the fence. That way the rabbits don't ever kill and damage the trees, but you still get that easy access to feeding them.
I can tell you how to get them to eat that nettle, but it's probably more work than you want to do.
Well, the nettle's not bother me. It's actually providing habitat maybe for, like, the cannabis is naturally covered, totally covered in ladybugs. There's ladybugs all over that system.
If you dunk that nettle in boiling water, it'll neutralize the chemical that causes the sting, and they'll eat it then. But that's just probably more work than you'd want to do for a rabbit to eat some.
Sure, sure. Yeah, there's plenty of food without any work right outside the colony for them.
Yeah, I'm with you on that. So I usually save questions to the end, but we have a couple here that are, like, so dead on to what we're talking about. I'd probably ask them if they weren't asked by the audience. So this is the big thing with colony rabbits. What do you do to keep them? You know, you mentioned they burrow and they go down in their burrows, and that's great. But how do you keep the burrow from coming up on the other end and the rabbit from escaping?
So I don't know if it's a combination of both the oversize of the area, in addition to what we've done with the chicken wire. But what we do is we've got we used a 4 foot roll of chicken wire, and we made an L shape. So it goes up 3 feet from the ground along that. It's basically just wired to that, or zip tied to that woven wire fence. And then on the bottom of the ground, we just have 1 foot of chicken wire on the ground, into the ground, that discourages them from digging right up against the fence. It's probably hard to see from the photo, but we have had, like, zero evidence of them ever even trying to burrow out. And so, once again, I think that also has to do with the fact that you can see the chicken wire just below the top line of that woven wire fence there. And so I think that they just have so much space, and they have so much, we're feeding them so much food. These rabbits eat very well, that they have no reason.
Like, that's what you said there. Have you like buried down in like a moat with the bottom of that wire, or did you like put a break in it? So if they start digging close to it, then they're hitting the wire, like, where it's L shaped, like, is that what you, because that's what I did in my aviary. I went down as deep as I could, hit rock, and I turned my hardware cloth out for a foot and buried it from the outside to keep things. I wasn't worried about getting out. I was more worried about getting in. Is that what you're saying? You kind of buried some of it to where, because most diggers, if they start hitting stuff like that, they're like, they're done.
Yeah, we didn't even bury it. We just put it right on top of the ground. Just pinned it right down with landscape pins or whatever.
I got
you. And so, that's kind of this other aspect that we take. Is like, we try and do the most simple, easy solution first and see if it works.
Sure.
Worked. And so we've not had to really improve that. So maybe in the future, and this kind of gets to the culture of animals. Like, as when we first introduced the rabbits from this tractor system, the rabbits were really not feral at all. They were friendly. We could pick them up. We could pet them. As they breed in that system, they become more and more feral to where they don't interact with us at all. They're scared of us. They run away. It's actually made the harvesting kind of a challenge in some aspects. This is another challenge to the system, is how do you actually catch them to harvest them? But
let me see if I can come up with a harvest rabbit methodology.
Yeah, that works.
I would probably not use a 40. I would probably use a Smith, like a 22, but
22
and suppress. And suppress, so they don't know, right? You don't want them to get that feral. But I'm wondering if part of the reason they don't. They,
I'm also wondering if part of the reason they don't burrow out, number one, you've got them backed off a foot from the fence anyway because of that break you put in the fence. But I think the other thing is maybe they're just not real prone to, like, I'm going to go in here and come up over here. So they're like, once they're down in, they make their burrow, they're not, like, tunneling out the other direction, I'm wondering. Like, if that fence was right on the ground and they could push under it, they probably would. But when it comes to burrowing itself, they probably have more of, like, not like a prairie dog, where prairie dogs have talons, and there's, like, up and out from, you know, like, they can go in here and pop up over there. I don't think rabbits are big on doing that in the first place.
Well, in this, so in that hugel culture mound, it is like Swiss cheese in that thing.
Really?
And they go through, and out the other end, and they've got all these entrances, exits. Okay. I've never actually been able to inspect and figure out what they're like, where they're all happening. I just kind of let it do its thing. But that might be another reason why they're not burrowing out in my instance, is because I've created this perfect place for them to put the burrows in. Anyways, they prefer to put it in this hugel culture mound rather than around the outside edges of the fence.
Okay, we have another question on the same topic that fits right in, so we'll go ahead and hit it before we move on. Bill says, how long have you been practicing raising rabbits in a colony, and have you used the same pen, and have you had any disease issues? I think he already hit the disease issues, but how long have they been in this space, and how long have you been doing this?
I think we put them in there in, like, the summertime of 2020.
Okay, 4 years.
But when we first introduced them, that was, like, not... It basically took a year for the system to, like, reach its equilibrium point where they'd eaten all the grass down and all this stuff. And that's when, like, this question is asking, when we ran into the disease issues of those eye infections and stuff. And so we've had to, like, the system is done, like, evolving in that way, I think. Now we kind of are focusing on improving the productivity of it instead of dealing with these unforeseen circumstances by just introducing the rabbits into a place.
Awesome. So let's move on. Like, you mentioned Bitcoin quite a bit right at the beginning, and you mentioned that it helped improve access, market access. Can you talk about how that's worked out?
Yeah, so when I started participating heavily in Bitcoin, I realized, like, people around me, my friends that weren't into Bitcoin, did not want to talk to me about Bitcoin all the time. So that quickly led me to finding Bitcoin meetups. And as soon as I went to the Bitcoin meetups, I realized, oh my gosh, this is like a place where people have Bitcoin. They want to use their Bitcoin. They're interested in participating in economies with other Bitcoiners. I should bring something to sell to these meetups. And so I started bringing maple syrup to the Bitcoin meetup, my local Bitcoin meetup. And it was very popular. I quickly sold all the maple syrup I could bring. And so that led me to start thinking, well, maybe I should start selling my lamb, try and take deposits in Bitcoin for this lamb that I produce. And last year, we ended up selling all of the lambs that we grew for Bitcoin. And so by attending these Bitcoin meetups, it's given me an access to a market where you could think of Bitcoin as like the border of a culture. And so, like, if you're in Europe and you don't have euros, then you can't buy shit. And so, like, if you're going to participate in the Bitcoin culture and you don't have Bitcoin, then you can't buy shit. And so I'm selling my stuff for Bitcoin exclusively to help bolster and create the circular economy of Bitcoin. And people are interested in participating in that culture and economy of Bitcoin, are willing to buy my products because I accept Bitcoin for it. So it's given me more market access to the kind of people that I want to participate with.
Yeah, I've noticed that Bitcoiners, two things about them. One, they want to buy things with Bitcoin. Right. Even if they're people like me that take the seller advice, never sell, right, your Bitcoin. I'll still buy stuff with Bitcoin. It'll just be new Bitcoin that buys stuff, right? So, like, I'm a big fan of Strike because I can put dollars in and spend Bitcoin out. So they want to spend Bitcoin in the first place because they want to participate in the Bitcoin economy. But the other thing is, and this is why I started doing Bitcoin Breakout as a thing onto itself, there are a shitload of people to me that seem to find Bitcoin. And they're not gardeners, they're not eating grass-fed meat, they're not purging seed oils from their life, they're not, you know, installing solar, when they find Bitcoin. And it seems like Bitcoin, like, pops this cork, and if you get involved with Bitcoin for long enough, you start to go, like, money's bullshit, right? The money they give us is bullshit, so if the money's bullshit, what else is bullshit? And that once they pull that thread, they go down this whole, they want to eat healthier food. They want to learn about growing their own food. They want to learn about alternative energy. And there seems to be this meshing bridge forming between the two communities to me.
Yes, the homesteading community, the permaculture community, and the Bitcoin culture and community are marching step by step towards each other. I found this to be the case in Michigan, where I'm at. There used to be only a handful of meetups just a few years ago. Now there's more than six meetups here. I go to the Southwest Michigan meetup. There's the Grand Rapids meetup. There's a great website actually called MichiganBitcoiners.com where you can see all the great Bitcoin events in Michigan. But it's what I found is that when you go to these Bitcoin meetups, you find people that are like, for example, when I go to the Bitcoin meetup, I can not only sell some of my products, but I can also buy yogurt, cheese, pork, honey, eggs. These Bitcoiners are starting to realize that, hey, we need to, first of all, I want to earn some Bitcoin. And if I'm going to earn some Bitcoin, I got to produce something. And the easiest thing to produce is food. And that's something that somebody needs every month to restock. So the local Bitcoin meetups here in Michigan are turning into like miniature farmers markets. But all of the people that are participating together are each producing one of these items to sell to each other and trade.
That's really cool. And I've noticed that too. Like when you go to a meetup, people want to know, like, is there a way that we can have commerce together? And that's actually a really cool thing, because that I've always said commerce is the foundation of civilization. Like, people stop killing each other because, like, I'm a tribe, you're a tribe, we see each other, let's kill each other. Well, that sucks. And then we started to realize, well, like, they might have something we want, and we might have something they want. And wouldn't it be better if we, like, had a reasonable exchange with each other? And so people are always, like, my number one question I get is, how do I build community? And the number one way to build community with people is do business with people. People talk about, like, well, you know, our grandparents had tighter community. Yeah, but they also, like, when they needed something, they didn't go 5 towns over to the mall. They went downtown to the hardware store, and they knew the guy there on a first-name basis. And they did business with each other, and they had kind of the commercial retail, and then they had kind of more of this gray market barter, I guess, because, you know, a lot of the stuff that happens this way never happened, if you know what I mean. And they had that, and we've lost that. So if we want to reestablish the community, one of multiple things I think we need to reestablish is this idea of personal commerce between each other.
Yeah, and like I say this often, that both permaculture and Bitcoin are the antidote to this fiat culture. Like fiat, when we adopt a fiat money, we develop this homogenized fiat culture. And that ends up being a centralized culture because fiat is inherently centralized. And so we've gone from a decentralized culture and community of interacting with our neighbors and doing commerce with our neighbors to heading to the centralized supermarket, right? And this is why Bitcoin is such a decentralizing force, especially when you combine it with permaculture, because now you're starting to create incentives for people to build community around these Bitcoin meetups again, start producing their own food, taking sovereignty back. And so this is, I think it's to me, it just makes sense that it's happening naturally. But I'm trying to basically set the example or show people or inspire people to, if you want to go to a Bitcoin meetup, the best and earn some Bitcoin, the best thing to do is show up, see what, if there's a hole in that market there, and if there's some kind of aptitude or product that you can produce, bring that product and try and make it available to your local Bitcoiners.
I'm just going to say, I bet you Biltong will sell at any Bitcoin meetup. I guarantee it. The only thing you got to do to sell Biltong is hand somebody one piece of it and then don't give them any more until they pay you. That's it. It's like drugs. First one's
and
free.
This leads to another point that I make a lot in that let's say you just have a town home or you don't have a huge yard and you can't make a huge garden, you can't be growing meat or producing maple syrup or whatever it might be. You might be able to get access to a product that the Bitcoiners want at the meetup. And maybe Biltong's an example of that, where you've got the connection of some Biltong that nobody else can get. So you buy that, you bring it to the meetup, and you maybe don't even have to mark up the price on it. This is just a way for you to dollar cost average into Bitcoin by providing market access to a good that the Bitcoiners want, right? So you trade your fiat for the Biltong, you bring the Biltong to the meetup, and now you turn the Biltong into Bitcoin. And that's a clean way to get no KYC Bitcoin with your dollars.
That's a valid point. Like, there's so many people trying to figure out how to do just that. I want no KYC Bitcoin. Now, I'm going to ignore the fact that a lot of these people that talk about tracking and all pay 95% of their bills with a Visa card. I'm just going to ignore that and let that go. But instead of all this convoluted shit, why don't you just sell something for Bitcoin? Right? Like, that is the easy answer. And people would say, well, nobody wants to buy something for Bitcoin. But did you ask? And did you go where Bitcoin people are? Right? Those are really simple things to do there.
Exactly. You go to the Bitcoin meetup. You try and bring $100 to the Bitcoin meetup. $100 bill. Hold it up and say, "Does anyone want to sell me Bitcoin at spot?" I don't think anyone's going to try and get that $100 from you. But if you bring $100 worth of biltong, let's say, it's going to be like you said, you'll sell it no problem. You'll be able to turn that $100 into Bitcoin very easily because you're providing a service or a good or product that the Bitcoiners want. And once again, somebody who goes to a Bitcoin meetup is interested in participating in the culture and community of Bitcoin, the economy of Bitcoin. They're not just looking to hold it for purchasing power increases. They want to actually build something here. So this is just a great way to facilitate the circular economy.
Yeah, and I'm just going to say, we have an electric sausage press that is being featured this week on our website, and that's a side hustle in a box right there, guys. I'll just say that. Rabbit sausage is delicious, by the way. Before we keep going deeper into Bitcoin, is there anything that you did with the rabbits as far as your colony of rabbits? You're like, if I had to move, something threw me out of where I'm at, or I just could, you know, Bitcoin goes to $1 million a coin and I just want a bigger place and I'm going to recreate the rabbit colony. Is there anything you would definitely do differently the second time around?
That's a good question. Well, I've definitely been thinking about having more than one. And the trick is figuring out how to, I would try and figure out a way to design a way to paddock shift inside the colony. Like maybe keep their burrows in one area, one centralized place, but then give them access to different areas of the colony at different times to let some real plants recover and grow in there naturally. Because, like I said, this has been the biggest challenge for us is making sure that we're adding enough material in there so that they have this cleansing action from the carbon or whatever. And I just feel like having a diversity of plants and everything can only be better for the rabbits. And then, obviously, their food is growing right in their colony, and I don't necessarily have to bring it to them all the time.
Yeah, that doesn't sound that hard. You just need more space, right? Like, to me, if you built, like, do the old Victory Garden with the chickens where they had the coop in the center and then you had the two runs on both sides. Chickens are easy because they go to the coop every night. But since you only have, you know, like a trio basically as your core, like right after you harvested your babies, the only thing to move would be the breeders. And if you stop feeding them on one side and you just opened a gate that went to the other side, they're going to go there. Like when they don't get fed for a while, they shall seek food. Like you said, they would lose their burrows, but I imagine that they could reestablish that pretty quick, especially if you gave them kind of a good, like that Kugel Mound seems like they probably got into that and they're like, oh boy, this is the place, guys. This is it right here. I've never heard of anybody doing that, kind of having a rabbit Kugel Mound. But when you think about kind of the open spaces and something like that, like that just has to be like as soon as they start digging, they're like, yeah, man, this is the place. So if you created like a two-sided system or even a three-sided system, or, you know, when I had 150 ducks on this 3-acre property, I had it cut into four sections at that point so they didn't overdo it, and I just had a different gate I opened every day. And so that was kind of like a larger paddock shift, but it would be pretty easy to do, and I could see a lot of advantages to it, like finishing out meat chickens in the one that was just abandoned by the rabbits and then harvesting the chickens and let everything grow back. Like, you could function stack the hell out of that.
Exactly. Yeah, just it would be basically as simple as adding more fencing, making it a little bit bigger, and then having these gates that you could open and close. I think that would work just fine. But, yeah, so if I were to redo the rabbit colony from zero with the intent, because once again, I built this cannabis garden first, and then I just introduced the rabbits into it. So it was designed to be a cannabis garden, not a rabbit colony. I just kind of modified it to make it work with the rabbits. If I were starting from scratch, this is something that I would include, is a way to exclude the rabbits from certain areas of the colony so that things could grow there.
Dark Horse may be answering somebody completely different, but it gave me an idea with your rabbits and your harvesting and moving and everything. He said call them call them, go to them so they know. And I don't know what he's actually saying there because I'm not privy to the whole stream of consciousness there. But I would bet that rabbits are as susceptible to conditioning with sound and food as anything else. And if, like, you just had a bell or something or said something every time you fed them, they would probably get very conditioned to that, to where when you wanted to move them somewhere else and you started feeding them in that area and you replicated that sound, they're going to come to it. It won't, you know, probably a couple, 3 weeks, and they'll be hooked on that sound conditioning. A Pavlovian response is what I'm talking about there.
That's absolutely the case. I mean, they know the sound of me scooping out the grain. They know the sound of the wheelbarrow with the with all the prunings in it. They know the sound of the .22. And so this actually gets to an aside point that I didn't really talk about, and that's the challenge of harvesting rabbits in the colony. So we have three different ways that we harvest the rabbits. One is with a live trap. And so the problem with the live trap is eventually the rabbits learn that the live trap, when you get in there, you never come back. That rabbit never comes back. You're basically fishing, and you always just catch the breeding stock, right? So you're like, okay, I got the breeding stock, let it go. Then another one goes back in there. So eventually the live trap stops working. So then the next thing we started to do was we made this kind of like the same similar concept to like a fish trap, where we feed them in a smaller enclosure, which we can put a door, enclose a guillotine gate, and drop it down, and then trap all the rabbits in this smaller place, and then we actually just fish them out with a net and get the rabbits we want that way. The problem is that eventually they learn that when we go in here and the gate closes, we're in trouble. So then they like are smart. There's ones that you can never catch that way. They're smart enough to wait until the action dies down, and then they go in and eat. And so then it leads to hunting them out with the .22 rifle. And I basically just stand from the outside and find, usually in the evenings or in the morning when they're kind of out and about looking around, I'll shoot them. But then they realize that, oh no, we start to get hunted out at this time of day, and they start hiding. So we have to kind of rotate between these three different methods of harvesting them to have a consistent way to easily get them.
I can see it now, a fully suppressed .22 with thermal vision. That's that's going to be the eventual like way to get the last rabbit. And how to justify buying equipment. Like,
you know, I didn't think about the suppressor, but that would be, I think that would actually solve that problem where they would learn that fast about it, and I could be far enough away.
Subsonics too, because like I have a 10/22. If you suppress it with subsonics, you can hear the fire pin click louder than the shot. That's wow. Like subsonic 22s are just super quiet, and they wouldn't have a clue except Joey's doing the death kick. Like, what's wrong with Joey? Oh, I see. And suppressors are just getting fat. Like, I just found out from one of my friends, like, it used to take 6 to 9 months usually to get your stamp for a suppressor. They're turning them around in like 2 to 3 days now. And like, this is off topic, but there's kind of a theory on that they're really worried the NFA is going to die the way the Supreme Court has been doing things. And it's highly unlikely they would ever give back all, because the stamp is a tax, right? It's hardly highly unlikely they ever give it back. But if it's going to die, they probably want to take as much money in with it as they can before it dies. But just anybody out there that's been thinking about doing the stamp thing and getting a suppressor, it's never been faster. They still go through your background check and all that. But again, they're turning around same week. So that's just made things a lot easier to do. And if you do it right, you can buy one suppressor that will handle multiple calibers and multiple weapons. So you don't have to buy one for every freaking gun. It's not like buying glass or something. But yeah, that would probably work. Is there any other specific challenges when it comes to operating and maintaining your rabbits and sheep? That seems like your two primary stock.
Yeah, I think this just comes to like the constant succession of our systems here. We're not trying to hold our systems to be static. So as things change, and obviously that first year to the second year with the colony was a big example of that, where we had to take the feedback and change what we were doing to accommodate what we were observing there. And so like with the sheep, as our fruit trees are growing in, and as we're planting more fruit trees, the shape and the sizes of the paddocks are always changing. So I'm having to continuously reinterpret how I'm running my fencing and what the grazing pattern is looking like, as well as the nature of the pastures is changing too. Sometimes we plow a field and we'll plant turnips there to reset it and then reseed that pasture. And so as things change, basically, the biggest challenge is just trying to reinterpret. You figure out, like, you spend a whole season, you get the system dialed in, you feel like it's humming, it's really working well for you, and then something changes and you have to kind of like refigure it all out again. And that's kind of the biggest challenge, but I think it's important to be flexible like that, because this is how you build the systems to be more resilient. Instead of trying to continuously hold a field to be a corn and soybean field, you kind of let the field tell you what it wants to do at the time, and then accommodate that with your workers, your animals.
Cool. What do you like about living a lifestyle like you have the most, where you've taken permaculture and Bitcoin and brought them together?
I think like the biggest example is that now we're able to, as we move forward with producing more of our own food, producing our power with the solar panels, just really developing the sovereignty from every direction, we now incorporating the Bitcoin into it means that like we've got actually a community of people that we're not only aligned with morally and ethically and on the same kind of mission as far as like homesteading and producing your own food, but also we have the tools in order to continue to work with each other should shit really hit the fan. It just feels like I've got this like I'm participating in a different state that's operating parallel to the existing system. And so that's just now my life. I just feel like I live in a different world, you know? And it's really fantastic. I can't say enough about it.
So you're a miner too, right? Are there any places like you're using mining to do something with like the heat, like the exhaust? I think you were making some kind of tea or something that I heard on the other podcast you were on.
Yeah, I basically made a Bitcoin mining food dehydrator, and so now I harvest. In the past, I would just kind of let all these ephemeral weeds and herbs that could be useful just go, because I had no way to preserve them effectively. But as soon as I built the Bitcoin mining food dehydrator, now I go and just, as I'm weeding my garlic, for example, there's this purple dead nettle, which is a weed in there, but that's actually a powerful antihistamine. So I put that, harvest it, put it in my Bitcoin mining food dehydrator, and now this is a tea that I can drink to alleviate my allergy symptoms. So I'm getting my allergy medicine as a byproduct of me weeding my subsistence crops, and I'm getting paid Bitcoin to process it. That's just one example. I said, as I mentioned, we do these short-term rentals of this tiny house. This year, we produce a lot of laundry. So I basically cut a hole in the back of my clothes dryer, and I piped a Bitcoin miner into it. And so now we dry all of our clothes with the heat, the excess heat from the Bitcoin miner.
What you're going to say then is are you taking the dryer and running it on like cool mode to get the motion and then providing the heat from the miner? Is that what you're doing?
Exactly. I just have it on air dry. It blows the air in. And the heat is actually coming not from the heating element of the dryer, but from the Bitcoin miner. So it still tumbles. It still operates exactly like a normal clothes dryer, but the heating source is a Bitcoin miner.
I've always wondered this. Like, I don't really deal with cold very much down here, but if I lived in a temperate climate like you do, I think you said Michigan or Minnesota, somewhere up there where it friggin' gets cold as shit. Like, if you had something like a 10 by 20 or 12 by 20 greenhouse, you know, how many miners have to go in something like that to keep the temperature from freezing overnight? That would be an interesting equation, because if you're mining the Bitcoin anyway, then just like biochar, the easiest thing to do to get a second thing is do something with the heat.
Yeah, and in my case, I'm actually using the Bitcoin miners for the work, for the heat first, and the Bitcoin is actually just a subsidy to the cost of the electricity. So like a good example of that is I make maple syrup, and I use a reverse osmosis filter to concentrate the maple sap before I start to boil it. Now, the problem with the reverse osmosis filter is it doesn't work very well when the water or fluid that you're putting into it is cold. And the maple sap is like anywhere from upper 30s to lower 40s. So the filter is very inefficient at removing the water at those temperatures. So what I did is I put a Bitcoin miner in canola oil, and I used the canola oil to just preheat that sap right before it goes into the reverse osmosis filter to increase the efficiency of that system. And so now I'm getting paid Bitcoin to basically double the production of my equipment. Once I added the Bitcoin miner to this reverse osmosis system, Not only did I was I able to produce process twice as much sap, but I was able to get it to be actually at higher concentrations of sugar as well. So that not only saved me propane in boiling it down, but the Bitcoin actually subsidized the cost of the production too. And so I actually would challenge somebody who's producing a product if they can integrate Bitcoin mining into it. That's going to lower your overhead overall, and you're going to be more competitive. And over time, people that are using Bitcoin miners to subsidize the production of their products will be able to outcompete those who don't.
It's just a small-scale version of Michael Saylor's stuff about, like, you know, when he's like, there's these places where you got this 100-foot waterfall, and there's no way to have enough capital to create power out of it because there's not enough people there. But if you mine Bitcoin with the power, then you have the power for other things too, and you can create, you know, small communities around this by using, instead of government money to subsidize energy creation, Bitcoin money to subsidize energy creation. And all you're doing is taking that from like a community scale to a homestead scale.
Exactly. Yeah. I dehydrate things with the Bitcoin miner. I dry my clothes. I use the extra solar power from our solar panel system. I'm using Bitcoin mining to help me produce this maple syrup. I use it to help grow the cannabis, actually. And you mentioned a 10 by 20 or a small greenhouse, right?
Yeah.
I just use one single, a small, like basically a 1,000-watt Bitcoin miner to heat a cold frame, in which I use to start the cannabis.
Yeah.
So that the cold frame is just the size of a sliding glass door. So it's like 8 by 4 or something like that. I don't know. The 4 by a sheet plywood, whatever. But it's a small area. But the Bitcoin, over this last winter, because it was before the halving, I was actually mining profitably, so I could just let that thing run, and it was growing my cannabis. And then the cannabis that I produces cannabis seed, which I sell for Bitcoin. So now my Bitcoin mining is helping me produce a product in which I'm going to be earning Bitcoin with. And I hope this starts to, like, this is back to this whole point of the show, is like, once you start to integrate all the systems together, if you integrate Bitcoin mining into your food production systems, and then you use the products that you're producing from your food production system to earn Bitcoin, now it's starting to be this, like I said, this like whole cohesive other world that I'm existing in, that's totally revolving around Bitcoin and self-sovereignty, production, food production, energy production, so on and so forth.
Gotcha. You kind of mentioned this tea. So, like, you basically created like a dehydrator using a Bitcoin miner, right? And I guess then that could be, you could dehydrate anything. You'd make beef jerky with that.
Now, the temperatures, depending on how what you're comfortable with, right? Like, I am confident, and I haven't tried to dehydrate any meat yet with it.
Yeah.
Because I'm only getting temperatures of, like, 130, 135 max.
Fine. That's fine. If you're a purist like me, you don't even want it that high for beef jerky. You want it down in, like, 110, 120. So, yeah,
okay,
no problem.
So what I've read is, like, You typically want higher temperatures than that, but I, like I said, I don't know. But basically, yeah, I dehydrate all kinds of stuff. I make garlic powder with it. I've made raisins with it, apple chips, all kinds of shit. Dehydrate strawberries, all fruit. And basically, it's, once again, I just took a box. I took the dimensions of a commercial, like an Excalibur food dehydrator. I just copied that, made a plywood box with trays, same amount of trays, and just put a hole in the back of it, and I literally just put the fan of the Bitcoin miner up against the hole, and it's it. It's like the simplest thing you could do. If you can't heat your house in the wintertime with the Bitcoin miner, you can certainly use it to dehydrate some stuff.
Yeah, absolutely. And then dehydrating any kind of vegetable or whatever, like, that's as high as you'd want to be. I mean, your best vegetable dehydration is done in, like, the 80 to 90 degree range, because otherwise you start to cook. So, like, there's plenty of heat there to do a lot of things with. And then with greenhouse applications, I would wonder about, is there some way to, like, blow that heat around some foil pipe and heat water? Because water is the great battery for things like that. So then it's not, you know, then you've got kind of this this radiant heat coming off of the warmed water. Like, it seems like there's a lot of ways that can be channeled.
Absolutely. And that brings, so this is kind of the next stage of this Bitcoin clothes dryer project, where the exhaust from the clothes dryer goes into an area in which it would be very easy for, it's a southern facing area, it would be very easy for me to basically put a greenhouse up against my house. And then, like you're saying, I could catch water off my gutter, put it in a barrel, have the exhaust from the clothes dryer blow against that barrel. So not only is it going to heat the air in the greenhouse, but it's also going to help heat the water up in that barrel. And the barrel will help act as a battery. So when the clothes dryer is not running, I'm still getting some heat radiating into that greenhouse area. And so we'll see if I can get that to work. I don't know if I'm going to have time to build that this fall, but that's the goal, is to build it in the fall and see if I can play with it this spring.
There's always one more thing to build, isn't there? And then you always are like, I'm never going to do everything. You got to pick and choose what you do, man, because I can tell you're like me. You just like to do stuff. Let's see what'll happen.
Yeah, I get to it eventually, right? It's just, if it doesn't happen this year, it'll happen next year, the following year. And if it doesn't happen at all, it's because I figured out a better way to do whatever I was trying to do anyways.
Very cool. Very cool, man. Let's take some audience questions here. And K-Bonk asks, what kind of sheep and rabbits do you have?
So the rabbit breed is Silver Fox. It's a dual-purpose breed, good for the meat and the pelts. And I think I listened to the other show on the rabbits recently, and I'm doing the same thing, basically freezing the pelts. We do pickle and preserve some of them, but we haven't actually successfully made the pelts into any usable, saleable product. It's just an option that we have moving forward. And then as far as our sheep, we have Katahdin hair sheep, which we use to produce the lamb. And we actually also have East Frisian dairy sheep, which we're milking. We're just milking two of them right now. We've got two more on deck that we're going to breed this fall. So we're going to be milking four sheep next year. We're getting about a half gallon a day from those two sheep combined, which is definitely more than enough milk for what we need. We're starting to make yogurt, cheese, cream cheese, ice cream, that sort of thing with the extra milk, and freeze it too. And if the milk gets dirty, we also make soap with it.
Okay.
So or at least any milk.
Yeah. Question from Agrarian Crunchurian over on Rumble. Rev, you mentioned rentals and rams as primary income sources. Are the rabbits just for personal consumption, or is there a demand for rabbits in your market and meetup?
A lot of people do want to buy the rabbit. And it's just, like I said, the system, we haven't dialed it into the point where we're like really producing rabbit meat. This, once again, it's a cannabis garden first, and the rabbits are kind of subsidizing the production of the cannabis. And so we're getting the meat almost as a byproduct. But there is demand for this meat, and so I'm trying to figure out, once again, ways to like make sure that they don't die when there's a heavy rain, so we get more than 50 rabbits a year out of the system, more than what we could even eat, and then I would be able to sell that. But for now, the meat from the rabbits is just for us, and the primary product that we're producing is this cannabis seed in that system.
Is it primarily a like avalanche cave-in reason that they die in the rain, or do they get caught out in it and get cold when they're young and die from that? Because I mean, when I had the aviary, when I would put young quail in there, sometimes I would get, like, it would rain and get cold in the spring, and they would all huddle in a corner, and it would be an exposure issue because they were stupid and they didn't realize all the shelter that was in there. Or is it primarily a cave-in problem you're having?
I'd say it's a combination of both, but primarily it's a cave-in. The soil is just very sandy. And so it holds its form for a while, but in a heavy rain, if it gets saturated enough, it will just collapse. And so we've tried to do some things like I've seen people do these 5-gallon buckets with a tube coming out of it. And we buried some of those in there. And the issue with that is that we weren't able to do a good job of actually installing them. So I think that they were getting too hot and the rabbits weren't really using them. We just had the white lids on top that were exposed to the air. I'm like, we need to put a piece of carpet over that or something to insulate it a little bit better. And my wife disagreed. You know, we basically couldn't come to an agreement on the best way to solve this collapse issue. So it's just still ongoing. We haven't really solved it yet. I'm thinking also we've got a lot of these. So there's drain tile that's in my fields, and it's old clay drain tile. A lot of times that breaks up, and you got to dig it up and replace it with the plastic shit. And so the clay tile is probably pretty good for just like, burying that in the hugelkultur mound, and that won't collapse, and that'll at least give them some a better structure to work with, you know what I mean?
Yeah.
But once again, this is all just like something that I need to have time to do, and we're happy with the amount of rabbit that we're getting in the system right now. Eventually, we will work on this.
Yeah, I was thinking maybe pipes, some big pieces of pipe in the ground they could use as burrows, and but the one thing you'd have to do is anything you did like artificial construction is burrows, is, and you mentioned the tiles, like good drainage. Because, you know, you can prevent the cave-in, but then you create the drowning. So, I mean, that would be exactly something to think about, right? So everything has a trade-off.
Caving in or flooding to the point where the kids drown, or they get too wet and they get washed out of the berth. Like, even if they don't drown, they're sometimes flushed right out of there, and they're kind of sprawling around, and they're too cold. And heavy rain is basically the biggest problem that we've got with that system.
Okay. K-Bonk, he must have heard this on that other podcast I'm thinking about, because I'm pretty sure I did too. He said, what made you think of canola oil for the miners? And I think you're using oil to cool them? Is that what that was? I can't remember exactly.
Yeah, so the canola oil is a dielectric fluid. And typically when people when they do immersion Bitcoin mining, they get these specialized dielectric fluids to cool the miners. Bitcool is an example. Well, Bitcool, you can't really buy it a gallon at a time, and it's pretty expensive. And for my application, it wasn't even easy for me to get. I needed the dielectric fluid like right now, because I didn't realize when I was making this maple syrup, I basically doubled the amount of taps that I did for the maple syrup production, but I did not double the size of my equipment. And I quickly realized that I had a bottleneck that I needed to solve, or I was going to lose all that sap to spoilage. And so the canola oil was something that I could go get immediately at the grocery store and use as a dielectric fluid. The problem with canola oil is that it will not last, theoretically, and I'm testing this right now, the Bitcool or whatever these specialized dielectric fluids are supposed to last for like 10 years or longer, whereas the canola oil will probably lose its dielectric properties much more quickly, and you'll have to be replacing that. So that's maybe this trade-off of having to constantly be changing out your dielectric fluid using the canola oil. But either way, it's something that anybody can get and experiment with Bitcoin immersion mining. Right now, you could even go to the gas station and get this stuff, right? And it'll work just fine for short-term applications, definitely. I mean, I've proved that.
Very, very cool. Let's continue on with the Q&A here. Somebody asked, how do we find Bitcoin meetups? And I'm going to say I found mine by going to meetup.com, and that seems to be what most people use to create meetups. You got any other alternatives to that?
Meetup.com is a lot of Bitcoin meetups organizers are trying to get away from meetup.com, but it's still a pretty ubiquitous way to find a Bitcoin meetup in your local area. In addition to meetup.com, the Orange Pill app is a really good way to find Bitcoin meetups. Now, I believe the Orange Pill app is also a pay, like, as the user, you have to pay to see where these Bitcoin meetups are. So that might be a little bit prohibitive. There's some ways to find them on Noster now with this application called Flockster, which is kind of like a meetup.com substitute utilizing Noster. But ultimately, meetup.com and Telegram, honestly, as much as I am trying to get away from Telegram, if you find some Bitcoin-related Telegram groups, or just kind of put the message out there on even X or on Noster, people will, you could say like, hey, I'm in this state or this general region. Does anyone know where the Bitcoin meetup is? Somebody's going to know, if you're connected to any Bitcoiners at all, where those meetups are. There's a lot of ways to find Bitcoin meetups, basically.
And I don't really get this question exactly as asked, but Victory Garden says, Bitcoin mining as a subsidy is for heating operations, basically. I feel like there has to be a no-brainer that everyone would benefit from rather easily, but I'm a BTC dummy, so the concept matters. I guess what he's saying is, like, there's always something you can do with heat, and it seems like anybody can find a way to benefit. And I guess I would say that, like, the way to look at this, and you correct me if you think I'm wrong here, but creating heat with Bitcoin mining is a pretty expensive way to create heat. So what makes it viable is I'm mining for Bitcoin, and then I'm doing something with the surplus energy that's being exhausted as heat. And you have to come at it with that mindset, not I'm going to heat my house with a Bitcoin miner so my electric bill goes down, because that's not what's going to happen directly anyway.
It all depends on if the heating application is electric to begin with, then a Bitcoin miner, like you're saying, will subsidize the cost of that product or use case, right? So if I have a space heater and it's a 1,000-watt space heater and I'm just wanting to heat my toes under my desk in the wintertime, instead of using a space heater, if I use a Bitcoin miner, that's just going to be better, because I can spend that. I can basically sell that Bitcoin back and subsidize the electricity cost of running that heater. And so this is why I, like, now if you compare it to, like, using a propane or natural gas or even wood heat, now you're starting to have to make that trade-off. Like, well, yeah. It's certainly cheaper to burn the wood to heat the house than to use a Bitcoin miner. But if you want to use the Bitcoin miners, like for these weird food dehydration, right? I don't know of a propane food dehydrator. Obviously, if you built a solar dehydrator, that would be better. And in the instance of like drying clothes, a clothesline is a much more efficient way to dry clothes if you're looking to save money, right? But if you're looking for the convenience of a clothes dryer, maybe you could compare a natural gas or propane clothes dryer, and I'm sure those exist, to an electric one, it's probably going to be more cost effective to still use the propane. It all depends also as well on your electric rate. So yeah. Sometimes in rural areas, you can have a pretty nice electric rate where it starts to get competitive with these other, like with natural gas or propane. Probably never with wood, though. Honestly, wood has got to be the cheapest way to heat if you can do
it definitely is. I'm back to it. Probably makes the most sense that, like, your mental application initially is, I want to mine the Bitcoin. Now what do I do with the heat? And then the subsidy is however it works out.
Another way to look at it, too, is, like, I already had the Bitcoin miners. So, like, if I own a Bitcoin miner and it's not hashing, then I'm wasting it. So
it's stranded capital.
Once you have a Bitcoin miner, you have an incentive to figure out ways to utilize it. So that's a lot of people ask, like, does it make sense to, like, build a solar power system to mine Bitcoin? And I don't think that is necessarily true. But if you're building a solar power system to power some things, some essential loads in your house, and then when you have extra power to include a Bitcoin miner as part of that system to be a load balancer, let's say, then it starts to make a lot of sense.
Yeah.
So you have to think about it a little bit creatively.
Yeah, I mean, I had Brian Harrington on. He was with somebody else. Now he's with Fold. And he has a solar array on his house and battery backup for it. And the way he has this configured is, so he's not using much electricity when he's at work all day long. So all day long, the sun's beating on the solar panels. They're charging the battery bank up. When the battery bank hits 100, it automatically kicks the Bitcoin miner on. It uses a surplus production for the entire day, runs the miner, and then when the sun goes down, the miner shuts off. And so I think that's the way, but it's something to that effect is how he has it set up. So the array's there anyway, the miner's there anyway, you might as well use the surplus energy to run the miner. And I think that's, we have to start thinking more like that to find these creative applications for integrating these systems. None of them are in themselves directly, let's say, profitable, but when combined, they spit out profit. I did a show yesterday on selling, and I said one of the rules with that is never leave money on the table. And so what we're doing is taking the money that's sitting on the table and not letting it go away. That's the better way to think about it, I think.
Absolutely. Yeah. If you can start to make an output of one, or like a waste product of one system be an input for another system, now you're just using energy. And this goes back to the permaculture principle, catch and store energy, right? You can continue to move that energy and keep redistributing the surplus. And this is why I think the third permaculture ethic is it's described as redistribution of the surplus back to the system. I think an easier way to say that is non-extraction, right? So, like,
correct.
As long as you're taking the outputs of your systems and continuing them down and filtering them through other systems, you're not extracting energy from your system. You're keeping the energy on your homestead or whatever longer. You're going to end up with more capital at the end because of that effort.
Entropy will always win in the end, but how many times can we bounce the ball before it peters out and leaves us? That's kind of the approach there. And that is the permaculture approach to, like, water management, waste management, all of that. Like, we will eventually lose to entropy. You know, eventually the earth will go into a cinder. But how long can we keep the ball bouncing before we let it go? This is another question. I think there's a word missing from it. Bill said, how do winter water? I think he means, how do you deal with water in the winter for your stocks? Because you live where it freaking freezes.
Well, this is kind of a cool, so on my property, I've got several year-round springs. And so as far as the sheep are concerned, we just designed their winter paddock based around this flowing water, and then they have access to water that's all winter. And so that's pretty easy. As far as the rabbits is concerned, we basically just bring if they don't drink much, right? So you just have a pan out there, you bring a hot water from the spigot or whatever out, and you just dump it in there, and they get their drink. And it's as simple as that. It's really not too complicated. For our horses, we have this, we have basically a float valve on their water trough. And then we have this device called a freeze miser. So we've got a hose running and feeding that float valve all winter. And when the water is, when the temperature goes below freezing, it basically, this freeze miser opens up and lets a trickle come out. And so we're just all, and that last year was the first year we used that thing. It was freaking awesome because the horse water was actually the hardest part. We had to go out there with an axe and chop a hole in the big 100-gallon tank or whatever.
Yeah.
Was very challenging in the past. But now with this float valve and this trickle system, the, it was like below zero many days, and we had no freezing water hose lines. And the hose is just laying right on top of the ground.
Yeah.
So that freeze, and it's like a, maybe it's a 100-foot run of hose. It's a long run of hose to where you'd think that you'd get a frozen spot at some point, but it works perfectly. So
very, very cool. Yeah, because water can be challenging when you get into the freezing temperatures. But like you said, like, so you might have 50 rabbits in there right now, but by the time we're talking about freezing, all baby bunnies have graduated, and you're only dealing with a handful of rabbits, so they don't need that much water.
Yeah, it's basically the breeding stock, so the three does and the one buck, and then whichever of the smart ones that we couldn't actually fish and catch out of the, hunt out of the system. Ones that they're smart enough to survive, you know.
Those are good ones to eventually replace your breeding stock with, though, because they don't die in the weather, and they're smart, right? So they're your survivors, so you're going to get stronger stock eventually.
Yeah, I don't know. Sometimes I wish they were a little bit easier to harvest. Like, yeah, the ones that you don't catch, you can't catch, I don't necessarily want them to be teaching all the other ones to be hard to catch, too.
That's valid. That's Greg Judy with, if a sheep jumps over the fence, he shoots it. Like, he doesn't put it back in because, like, he's like, you'll come out there and you'll find one sheep over the fence. So you throw his ass back over the fence. The next day there's three. You throw them back over the fence. The next day there's 10. But if you shoot his ass, the other ones are like, yeah, I don't like that path. That's a bad path. So he's like, a 30-06 is 100% effective. And he's dead on there.
We do have that issue, too. And it's amazing how the animals can teach each other. I mean, we have this problem. We have chickens, and we used to do this leader-follower system with our sheep and our chickens. And we thought and this is one example of, like, how when you're designing systems, do not try and copy other people's techniques exactly. I fell into this trap when I was first getting started homesteading. Oh, so-and-so has figured out the way to do this. This is the best way to do it. And it was like, No, that's the best way for them and with their aptitude, skill sets, and situation, right? And so instead of being, I made the mistake of trying to copy these systems and apply it to my situation, and it didn't work, right? So we're following these chickens behind the sheep, and it's like a lot of work for what seems like nothing. And so we just gave up with the fencing and let the chickens free range behind the sheep. Well, now we've got this culture of free-range chickens, so now when we want to contain them and have put them on a job of composting horse manure, all they want to do is figure out ways to get out of our enclosure. And so the same is true of the sheep. If you let one start leading the pack out, then the culture, all the other sheep start to learn, like, hey, we can do this too. And that's why it's very important to get, like, we're probably not as fast as Greg Judy as far as, like, dispatching that animal immediately, but certainly at the end of the season, when it comes down to it, of the ewes in for processing for mutton, and those problem sheep are the first on the list, right? We're culling those from the flock, and we're going to
replace them. Yeah, he's in a different world. He's managing 10,000 plus acres, and he's managing thousands of heads of sheep. So one goes. Like, that's, he's like, that's table meat. He's like, whenever one gets out, that's just okay. That's our meat for the next 2 months. Like, that's, so it's a different world when you're. People like Greg are great because you learn a lot from them. The other side is they oversimplify sometimes, because if I only have three ewes, popping one ain't as easy for me as if I have 3,000 of them.
But you need a certain density of animals to maintain your stocking rate for whatever your pastures can support. And so if we kill all of our, remove them, then we don't have enough sheep to actually produce enough lamb to effectively graze the pastures that we have. So we have to do this dance. When you're Greg Judy, you can afford to just create that proper culture immediately. But for us, we have to kind of dance around with it a little bit more.
Yeah, gotcha. So Nurse Wang says, and I think we kind of hit this already, but we'll just real quick hit it again here at the end. Any issues with Codicius with rabbits on the soil? I probably said that name wrong. But basically, he's asking about any disease issues with the rabbits.
Coccidiosis, I think that's that, and I may be wrong about this, I think that would be if we were to, say, mix our chickens and our rabbits together. I think the coccidiosis is in the chicken manure, and that might cause problems for the rabbits, or maybe it's the other way around, that there might be something that's a problem. The chickens might have coccidiosis issues. I'm not sure, but as far as I know, we have not had coccidiosis issues, unless that's what has been emerged from these eye infections that we are getting. I don't know if that's caused by coccidiosis, but earlier, to reiterate from before, the biggest health disease issue that we had with the rabbits was having eye infection issues, and we solved that by just adding more carbon, more straw, more wood chips to the system, and now the eye infections have gone away.
And there are some folks asking about Bitcoin addresses and what have you for you, Rev, and I'll just say Rev is on Noster, and I've got his Noster profile up here. I will make sure there's a link where you can find him on Noster with whatever client you're using in the audio notes today, because I think there's some people that want to throw some value back at you for today's episode, and I would say that's probably the easiest way to do it. And most of the people that are wanting to do it probably are on Noster, and if you're not, you should be. So get on there, right?
I mean, to the point of Noster, I like to discuss, like, talk about Noster as like the decentralized location for the Bitcoin community and culture to develop, for us to build cultural capital. I found it very effective in not only earning the zaps from the content that I produce, but also, once again, gaining market access. Most of the cannabis seed that I sell via promoting it on Noster. So Noster is an excellent place if you're a producer of something and you want to earn Bitcoin, you can find a market there.
Yeah. All right, man. Well, hey, I had a great time with you today. I actually would like to maybe sometime in the future bring you back on as a 100% kind of Bitcoin-directed conversation, because I think you're doing a lot of cool stuff. And I think this is the way that a lot of people need to start seeing Bitcoin, is how it can integrate with everything in your life. But you've done a great service to people today. I think people really enjoy hearing from you. So thanks for being able to stay. You got anything you want to say before I let you go?
Yeah, I'll just do a shout-out, and this isn't a shill for myself, but I just want to meet everybody that I can and that might be in Michigan or close enough to attend this event. August 10th, so coming up soon here, is the Lake Satoshi Bitcoin Retreat. That you can come on the 9th. It's basically a camping event. You come, show up, set up your tent, bring your RV, and it's basically like a little, I call it like the regional Bitcoin meetup. So there's going to be everybody that attends the Bitcoin meetups here in Michigan, if they can make it, are going to be there. And then additionally, further out than that, even as far as Indiana, Chicago, Milwaukee, so on and so forth, there'll be a lot of people from there. It's a great place to meet your fellow Bitcoiners, to participate in the circular economy, and there's also workshops and talks going on as well. So it's just an awesome event. I went last year, my favorite event, a Bitcoin event of the year. So once again, the Lake Satoshi Retreat, August 10th. You can show up on the 9th. And make your way out. If you can come, I'll be there. You can come meet me too.
Is there info about that somewhere online, like a link or something you can pop over to me and I'll add to the audio notes?
Absolutely. I'm pretty sure it's just lakesatoshi.com, but I'll double check on that and send you a link.
I'll check on my end too. And if you just bounce me the link, I'll be sure I got it right. So folks, with that, I'm going to let Rev go. But about 30 minutes from right now, if you get over to the survivalpodcast.com or bitcoinbreakout.com, either, and look up the audio version of this video if you're watching the video. Links to his NPub, his Noster profile, all that will be there, along with everything else we've talked about today. Again, every day I do this, somebody clicks it and says, the link doesn't work. We're not done yet. We'll be done soon, and I'll get the audio up as like an archive. And, dude, thanks for being with us today. This was awesome.
Yeah, I had a great time, and I'm happy to come back and talk just Bitcoin, too.
We'll do that in the future, definitely, man. Take care. All right, folks, thanks for joining us today. Real quick before we wrap up, let me remind you a couple of ways you can help support this show. One is become a member of the Member Support Brigade. And, yes, I do take Bitcoin for that, as well as cash money or silver or pay by credit card, debit card, however you want to. But it's $50 a year. You get a ton of discounts. Those discounts will pay for the membership easily. Like, we had a Bubphone as our sponsor yesterday. They do $75 off a phone. for a $50 annual membership. You get that. That's just one discounter. I recently ordered some stuff from Acura Botanicals, cannabis-related stuff, and, I mean, one order I saved like $65 on with the discount there. So, and there's like 70 other companies that do discounts. Seeds, we got that. Tactical, practical, everything. And so you help support the show, then use the discounts, get your money back. I tried to do that so that everybody wins. The other way is do your online shopping at tspaz.com. That's T-S-P-A-Z. And I do my item of the day. You guys know I bring these items around that I review. Some are on Amazon. Some are from a company called Vavor that I've been working with a lot this year. Today's item of the day is from Vavor, and it is not a prepper item. It is just not a prepper item at all, unless you want to prep for a party. They make these awesome margarita slash slushy machines. I can never say slushy for some reason. As part of the sentence, anyway. But what I'm basically saying is you can make margaritas or daiquiris or anything like that, or you can make them without alcohol so they're virgin. And then if you want to, you could make – this is what we do at my nephew's. We make them so the kids can have them with whatever flavors they want. And if adults are drinking them and you want to slut them up a little bit, put a shot of rum or tequila or whatever in the bottom of the glass before you fill it up. These things are pretty badass. The double tank model is about $800. The single tank model is about $500. They rent for like $250 a day around here. Like a machine that looks like it's not made by Vavor, but it looks exactly like this. I looked it up in my local market, and it was $250 a day to rent one of these machines. So they pay for themselves pretty quick if you would use them. So this is kind of a party, fun, get-together item. But, I mean, I've seen people using them at, like, you know, you wouldn't think of this, but, like, church picnics and stuff like that. Because, again, make them for the kids. By the way, the favorite thing from the kids has been so far when we've been using this machine, blue raspberry. And I guess blue raspberry is good for everything. But the kids really love that. You can also just chill drinks. So you can have one side as a slushy side and one side like unsweetened tea, except you can't turn anything unsweetened into a slushy. You have to have, so it's high sugar again, 14% sugar of the solution for it to slushify, to become like slurpy, like daiquiri, like consistency. So again, not for everybody, but a really cool product for people that might be interested in it. And yes, I did give mine to my nephew and niece because they have this cool backyard. They do big parties like every other weekend and stuff, so they'll use it more. I've had it for like 3 months. My Vivor rep's like, when are you going to review it? When are you going to review it? When I review something that's this expensive, I want it used more than once before I recommend it to you. So I let these folks put it through its paces like multiple times. No problems. Works as advertised. Now I'm willing to recommend it to you. But it will be here. That was my deal. I will give it to you. And once or twice a year, I need it lent back to me. So our November workshop, which will be the week of November 11th, people are asking. It will be after the 11th because of the way things fall this week. It's like the 13th to the 17th. It's that Wednesday through that Sunday. Friday night, we always have catered fajitas. This year, we're switching from Uncle Julio's to a restaurant called Lupe Tortillas, and they are way better, and you get way more food for the money. They're going to be cooking on site, and we will be running the margarita machine to go with fajita night at the workshop in November, and that's the kind of place that something like this excels. A lot of people, on-demand beverages, so check it out again, the slush frozen drink machine. And then real quick before we sign off, because that's not for everybody, the other product that I brought out to you this last couple of weeks that really is for everyone is the Vavor Compact Air Compressors. These things are about the size of a brick, man, that you can fit in your vehicle, no problem. Save your butt on the side of the road. This is kind of the best one they make, the largest one. They also make some smaller ones that cost less money as long as you're like passenger car, smaller trucks would work fine, even the smaller ones. And they charge your electronic devices. So when I say for everyone, they really are. You can always help us out. How? Do your online shopping beginning at tspaz.com, where no matter what you buy, you will help us out. Thank you so much for tuning in today. Tomorrow will be an expert council, and I've got a really great lineup of expert council members tomorrow. The question we did last week, where we had multiple inputs on moving to a new property and getting started, Nicole Sauce has given her answer, so we'll have that tomorrow. We have some cool stuff from both doctors tomorrow, I think, and some other great stuff tomorrow. Tune in for. You'll hear from Sean Mills, John Pugliano, I think Nick Ferguson, definitely Ron Paul's crew over at Liberty Report. They just sent me their segment for tomorrow. Seems kind of spicy, so check it out. We'll catch you then. They said you should have a house, be a man.
dollar down, a dollar a month, and you'll